Call the education policy meeting to order. I know there are some members out in the hallway. Some members are picking up their lunch. But, you know, pretty soon we will have all members here and we'll have a quorum so that we can take a vote on these important bills that are before us this afternoon. So for now, I think I'm going to call Senator Carlson to the table. Senator Carlson, do you see your testifiers? I think I see Ms. Ballmer here. Okay, fantastic. Yes, and Mr. Furman is here too, so that's great. Senator, on Senate File 950, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have Senate File 950 to present to you. And being that I'm on the committee, I'd like to move that for passage. Senate File 950 does two things. It corrects an error that occurred while the Board of Teaching was conducting rulemaking for teachers of the deaf and hard of hearing. And it recommends a change in the 1999 session law regarding the number of clock hours required in American Sign Language and deaf culture for teachers of the deaf and hard of hearing. The bill was brought to me by the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. As an advocate for special education, I know how important it is to have specialized training for the different disability groups the state serves. With me today to address the omission of continuing education credits is Karen Ballmer of the Board of Teaching. Next, testifying about the importance of keeping continuing education credits in ASL and deaf culture and stakeholder consensus on reducing the number of ASL credits from 60 to 30 is Jay Furman, principal of Northeast District 916. And first we'll hear from Karen Ballmer.
Thank you, Senator. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. Yes, Ms. Ballmer, please welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I come to offer some insight and information and, of course, answer your questions specific to Senate File 950. We're grateful for Senator Carlson bringing this forward, and we hope to be able to move this forward. Just as by way of background, you've had a lot of conversation this session around the Board of Teaching's purview as it relates to teacher licensure testing, but our work goes far beyond that. This relates to the work that we do as in terms of setting the teacher licensure standards. And it's specifically not just to become a licensed teacher in any given field, but then how do you continue to renew your license in that specific field? And that's the issue that we're taking up today. So by way of some background, just a couple of notes. We began in 2008, actually, several years ago, a process of revising all of our special education teacher preparation standards. This work was massive. It encompassed 9 special education licensure fields. We established 2 additional special education licensure fields. And then there's a broad field of standards called the core skills that are required for all special education teachers. And we revised those as well. Of course, as in any work that we do, we were heavily informed by our stakeholders and practitioners and experts in the field. So we had actually 2 working groups specific to our license for deaf and hard of hearing teachers. So as we went through this process, which included, as all rulemaking does, extensive stakeholder engagement, we had a public hearing in September of 2011. We had a decision from our administrative law judge in December of 2011. The rules were adopted then, shortly thereafter, about a year ago, January of 2012, and now just effective January of this year, 2013. As you may imagine, it was, like I said, it was a massive undertaking. When we got the rule draft back from the revisor's office, it was 94 pages long. And so we, after going through that process, realized that we did have what we believed to be an inadvertent omission specific to the license renewal requirements for teachers of deaf and hard of hearing. And that's what we're here talking about today. So as I've combed through our materials and all of our documentation of our process, sincere belief is that the stakeholders that we brought together, those two working groups specific to this field, would support this movement of requiring the 30 clock hours for their license renewal. I believe this to be in keeping with what they had discussed and talked about and agreed to. But again, it was in an inadvertent omission in our rulemaking efforts. So I would happily stand for any questions about this specific provision or any others related.
Thank you, Ms. Wellmer. Please proceed.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jay Furman, and I'm a special education program manager for deaf and hard of hearing and blind visually impaired services at Northeast Metro Intermediate District 915 in White Bear Lake. I am here to speak in support of Senate File 950. I want to thank Senator Carlson for introducing this important piece of legislation. I also want to thank the Board of Teaching for the hard work they did convening a group of diverse stakeholders to update the skills, knowledge, and content areas needed for teachers of deaf and hard of hearing to practice in the state. A wave of changes has occurred since the last time the rules were written close to 20 years ago. Back then, most children who were deaf and hard of hearing were identified with hearing loss at around age 3 to 7 years, well past the threshold needed to achieve typical linguistic and developmental milestones. Most lagged far behind their hearing peers. With the advent of newborn hearing screening mandates, almost all children are tested at birth for hearing loss and are being identified much earlier. The other changes that have occurred are in technology, specifically hearing aid and cochlear implants. The increased racial and ethnic diversity in our state, and last, the increase to 30% of a number of children with co-occurring disability. The new standards reflect these changes. Retain the American Sign Language and Deaf Culture focused for continuing clock hours is important. Districts and teachers can't predict if a child will be a visual, auditory, or multimodal learner. Their need can change over time. Teachers need to be able to teach to the children in their district. Some will use American Sign Language or other visual communication mode. Some will use auditory oral or a combination of both visual and auditory oral methods. Since deaf and hard of hearing is a low-incident disability, it is imperative that every teacher for deaf and hard of hearing stand ready to serve students and maintain their skills. We must not lose sight of the importance of American Sign Language, deaf culture, and understanding hearing loss. That said, the stakeholders who participate in the rulemaking process agreed that 60 clock hours out of 125 clock hours is too much. Since its requirement was passed in 1999, the state had added required clock hours in 5 additional training areas. It is very difficult to cover 60 clock hours, meet other requirements the state had, and maintain the flexibility needed to take additional training if a teacher has a student who is deaf-blind or has other special needs. The consensus from the stakeholders was to reduce the number of continuing education clock hours for American Sign Language, Deaf Culture, and Understanding Hearing Law from 60 to 30. I believe that 30 clock hours is realistic, especially for teachers of deaf and hard of hearing who work in rural Minnesota. Each region has a lower incident disability facilitator who assist with providing opportunities for professional development related to American Sign Language and Deaf Culture. Technology has also made professional development more accessible, using webinars and interactive television. Thank you for your time, and we ask you for your support for the reinstatement of these requirements and recommended changes.
Thank you, Mr. Furman. Members, any questions for Senator Carlson or the testifiers? Senator Nina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Carlson, it was unclear to me. It was a little bit ambiguous in the language. Is the intent to stack on to the CE hours for a total of 150, or is the intent to include 30 within the 120?
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, I'm advised that it's within in number.
Madam Chair, maybe Senator Nino. Maybe counsel could comment as to whether that language is clear enough. To me, it was ambiguous.
Presume that it says for every 120 continuing education clock hours and the addition 30 will make it to 150, right? Or could you, Miss, could you?
Madam Chair, remember if that was 30 of the 120. So it wouldn't be more than 120 B.
Okay. So it specifically says 120. It's clear? Okay. Any other questions, members? Senator Clausen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm assuming that teacher preparation programs for the deaf and hard of hearing students require American Sign Language as part of the curriculum?
Ms. Bonner?
Madam Chair, yes, Senator Wilson, they do. American Sign Language is a heavy component of the preparation. There is also a requirement around the sign language proficiency, their signing proficiency as part of their preparation.
Senator Wilson.
Madam Chair, so that basically this is just an opportunity for them to maybe look at what is new in the American Sign Language curriculum and working in that area?
Ms. Baldwin.
Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, I think you may be better served by hearing from Mary Hartitt. My response would be that, as mentioned in Mr. Furman's testimony, teachers might not always have a teacher who they're within their caseload that they're serving that are signing students. I believe that the intent is to ensure that no matter what their caseload is, they may have students, for example, that use cued speech, the oral auditory types of strategies, and they may not be signing every day, but that they are, in fact, the ones that need to deliver those services and should be maintaining that practice and fluency throughout their license period. Mary Hartnett may be able to respond better. If I may.
Yes, absolutely. Please.
Just before you leave, just one clarifying question.
Senator Clausen.
Could this possibly be a requirement for a teacher that has never been taught American Sign Language as part of their training?
Ms. Ballmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, no, it is part of their preparation. And the renewal condition, which, as mentioned earlier, had been 60 clock hours within, is a continuing education requirement to ensure that regardless of whether or not they're actually serving deaf students who are signing and need their communication mode, that they are maintaining that fluency.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ballmer. Anything that needs to be added to that response, or is that we're okay? Okay. Senator Wigger.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Your grassroots did a very good job in notifying at least several of us on the need for this, so just wanted to do a shout-out for the teachers that indicated support. I had one question at line 1.16, the word or, wondering if and would better accomplish your intent, because you want sign language, linguistics, or deaf culture, but you want all of these taught, don't you? It's not one or the other. If this accomplishes what you want, but it appears to me the requirement would be you could pick and choose among those three.
I read it that way too, Senator Wigger. The or may not be. Senator Carlson.
I would think what I'm hearing is that it really is not a big issue, but I think and would probably be more effective, correct? Mm-hmm. And I would move that we amend it to change the or to an and.
Thank you. So Senator Carlson moves that we amend the word or on line 116 to replace it with and. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Any other testifiers, Senator Carlson, or would you like to do some closing remarks?
I'm good with what we've had, and I think this is an important correction to make, and I move for the committee to accept Senate File 950 as amended, and I would refer to you to say where it goes from here.
It goes to finance.
It goes to finance.
Is your preference to move it directly to the floor, Senator? You have both choices, but most of our bills now are going to be moved into finance into the omnibus bill, unless you request to move it directly. But I think that we should move it into.
Why are we moving it to the floor?
Okay. Senator Carlson, it's our understanding that in the House this bill is moving independently, so it moved directly to you. You have the choice, but in the House this bill has moved on its own, so it's not part of the omnibus bill. We will have to conference it if you move it.
Then we would like to move it on its own if it is moving independently. House, okay. Yes.
So floor. Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 950 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor as amended. Be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. On that motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee.
Next in the agenda, we have Senator Clausen.
Madam Chair?
Senator Carlson.
Does someone need this on?
I don't believe so. Thank you for asking. Turn that off. Thank you. And Ms. Abderholden, if you don't mind closing that computer, because I don't think we need it, and so we can see you. Great. Thanks. Senator Clausen? You have Senate File 1083, and we are ready for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Proceed.
Just for the record, my name is Greg Clausen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate. And Madam Chair and committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to present to you for consideration Senate File 1083. It's a proposal to clarify the use of restrictive procedures when working with special education students. There is an amendment to Senate File 1083, A13, which I believe you have. It simply clarifies a date within the Senate file.
Yes, Senator, we have it. So it deletes 217 and inserts 2015. Members, do you have that?
Yes.
So Senator Clausen moves the A13 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to start out by just giving you a brief history. In 2009, Minnesota Statute 125A.094 was passed, regulating how schools may use restrictive procedures for children with disabilities. The law went into effect in August 1, 2011. And the statute was further modified in 2012 as part of the Minnesota Omnibus Education Bill, requiring the Minnesota Department of Education to develop a statewide plan to reduce the use of restrictive procedures in schools and provide other positive behavior strategies and mental health support. Restrictive procedures are actions which limit a child's movement, include seclusion and physical holding or restraints in an emergency. It is important to understand these definition of the terms as outlined in Section 1 of Senate File 1083. Those are items A through G. And there are several terms that are listed there. They define emergency, the term physical holding, positive behavior intervention and supports, prone restraint, restrictive procedures, and seclusion. And all those are key to this bill and the proposal that's before you today. Between September 2012 and January 2013, the Minnesota Department of Education convened stakeholders to review the state restrictive procedures data that's collected by the department and identify components of a plan to reduce restrictive procedures for students with disabilities. Senate File 1083 includes the recommendations of the Minnesota Department of Education study, and there are six specific provisions that I'd like to point out. First of all, it does clarify those definitions that I've just shared with you. Secondly, clarifies the restrictive procedures cannot be used to punish or otherwise discipline a child. Thirdly, it strengthens the requirements and components of each school district restrictive procedures plan, including a provision for staff training. Part of the original bill was that each school district had to provide a plan on how they would implement the law. Fourth, it allows the use of prone restraint until August 1, 2015, and that was part of the Amendment A-13 that was just passed. It directs stakeholders in the Minnesota Department of Education to report to the legislature by March 1, 2014, recommendations on specific and measurable implementation and outcome goals for reducing the use of restrictive procedures and prone restraint. And lastly, it appropriates an unspecified amount in fiscal year 2014 to help school districts address the needs of children subject to high use of prone restraint. Just a comment about the study that was done. Stakeholders participating in the Minnesota Department of Education study and advocate groups are in agreement with Senate File 1083, with the exception of the extension of the use of prone restraints, which is found in Section 1, Item E. And prone restraint is defined as placing a child in a face-down position. And at this time, I'd like to introduce Sue Amberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota.
Welcome, Ms. Amberholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Proceed.
Members of the committee, Sue Amberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Over the last decade, there has been a move to reduce the use of seclusion restraints in hospitals, treatment facilities, community programs, and schools. Partly this move is due to unfortunate deaths, and partly to a push from the federal government through reports and rules issued by the Healthcare Financing Administration and the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. After several failed attempts at changing Minnesota rules on this issue, NAMI convened a stakeholder group to try to develop a community consensus on their use with children. So no matter where the children are, in school, treatment settings, et cetera, we're using the same philosophy and the same terms. This resulted in legislation passing in 2009, although I will note that it was still controversial and we were not ever able to get a hearing in the Senate. So it ended up in the omnibus bill. It was controversial in the fact that there were educators who believed that actually these procedures were useful in changing behaviors and their use should not be limited to emergencies. I will note that there are no studies that show they're effective in changing behaviors. There were many compromises made to get it passed, but there were four main issues that we never let go of. One was that these procedures would be banned except in cases of emergency, and I think that's a really important point to make. Number two is that they would only be used by certain personnel who had training to learn de-escalation techniques, to understand how to use these procedures safely and their impact on children, understanding the communicative intent of behavior, and a whole host of other topics. Three was that parents would be informed. Prior to this, parents didn't always find out that these procedures were used on their children. Number four would be that their use would be documented and reviewed so that they would really be assessing the incidents, kind of conducting a debriefing to look at maybe how things could have been handled differently and to look for patterns when they're used. While it passed in 2009, as Senator Clausen mentioned, it didn't go into effect until fall of 2011, knowing that schools needed time to kind of retrain their teachers. So we've really only had this law in effect for 1.5 years. It's a very short period of time. But we've already seen some very positive changes. NAMI, through working with CURA, was able to conduct a survey last summer of special education directors, and unlike back in 2009, they were actually really embracing the law. There was not one respondent that said, we should repeal the law. They found it helpful to have the additional training. They found that they had new techniques that weren't available to them before. They found it helpful to be able to review the data, and they also found it helpful to have meetings with the IEP team to try to figure out maybe what was going wrong and how these procedures, why they were used, and how could we do it differently in the future. They also identified areas of the law that needed clarification. This is really progress. I am really pleased that we have moved this far and that people have changed their views on these procedures and are working hard to figure out how not to use them. Have there been problems in implementing the law? Absolutely, as any new law, which requires a change in how you actually react and think about things. There were situations where the law was clearly violated, for example, using restrictive procedures when it wasn't really an emergency, but I don't expect perfection in a year or even two. What I do expect is engagement and commitment, and that we have. The bill before you today reflects the changes that were called for both in the surveys and in the task force report. As was mentioned, there is consensus on all the changes except one, although all the groups have signed off on the bill. And that, of course, is the continued use of porn restraints for 2 years. I want to be absolutely clear that there is not anyone in this room that likes or wants to use porn restraints. I do want to mention that we don't allow the use of prone restraints that restrict breathing, which has been the cause of death across the country for both kids and adults. NAMI's goal is to actually increase staff training, provide links to experts, and increase school-linked mental health services for these particular children so that they don't need to be used. So I want to make a difference between saying we are never going to use them and saying we don't need to use them anymore. Until we have something in its place, until we really have, you know, all the staff fully trained and really figuring out how to do this differently, we are concerned of the kind of unintended consequences. One will be that schools will use the reasonable force statute, which we have, and schools can respond to any situation to keep a child safe or to keep other people safe. The reasonable force statute requires no reporting, no training, or anything else. We're afraid that they will call the police, which will frankly increase our school-to-prison pipeline, which we also don't think is a very good idea. Or schools will place more children on homebound, and I can tell you that is not something that these parents would look forward to. These are not good alternatives. By allowing their use for 2 more years, we will have the opportunity to continue to work to decrease their use, a goal that is embraced by everyone. This bill has been carefully crafted. We have really worked very hard together to try to come up with something that we can all agree on. But I will say that the goal of everyone in the room, unlike in 2009, was that we do not want to use these procedures, we want to find alternatives to them, and we want to help these children. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Upton Holden. Next testify.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Connie Hayes. I'm superintendent at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District, and I'm here today to provide support for Senate File 1083. I was a participant on this Restrictive Procedures Work Group, which Sue Abderholden just spoke about, and I want to thank MDE for their skillful leadership with this discussion, especially around the issue of the use of prone restraint. Together with parent advocates and other educational leaders, we assisted MDE in their development of a statewide plan to reduce the use of restrictive procedures, including prone restraint. Our work group also developed the language for the bill here today. As educators and advocates around the table, it really was not very hard to agree on our common vision. We all want all of our kids to do so well in school that the needs for restrictive procedures are not necessary. Our differences, however, were grounded in our different experiences. The advocates hearing stories from parents about potential misuse of restrictive procedures, and our experience at the intermediate school district, where there are a relatively small number of students who display very intense behaviors resulting from their mental illness and or their disability. Although our work group developed a lot of consensus, and I really could say ditto to everything Sue just said, we do not have full agreement, and specifically on the use of prone restraint. We do understand that the parent advocates hear these stories from parents, and we understand their concerns and can agree with them. However, in our environment at the intermediate school district, The use of prone restraint is still a very important tool in the array of strategies our staff needs to use to ensure that the student, other students in the vicinity, and our staff will be safe. Based on the data presented by the recent Office of Legislative Auditors report, we now know fewer students with these very highly aggressive behaviors are being served in long-term residential facilities. That data verified our experience at the intermediate of more students with very complex needs than ever before. These students who can display highly aggressive behaviors toward themselves or others are being served in our public schools. However, nothing was done to prepare public schools like ours for this change in policy. What has been the impact of this? Well, our injury rate for staff in the workers' compensation world is 70% greater than other public schools. So we have been responding by investing more and more resources in training our staff how to manage these oftentimes explosive behaviors. Training has really become one of the cornerstones of our program at 916. We are teaching our staff to identify, if they exist, the triggers to the student behaviors and then how to use strategies to de-escalate those behaviors. Whereas before we invested in this training, our staff instinctively might have put hands on the student when an aggressive threat was made. Oftentimes now, they will hold back and use the strategies they've learned, and oftentimes the behavior does de-escalate. We train our staff to use these procedures, including prone restraint, and then we retrain them every year. This ensures that when an emergency is underway where others are at serious risk of harm or the student is at risk of seriously harming him or herself, they will use prone restraint very safely. With this kind of commitment to training, no student has been injured in a prone restraint in our district, and no staff have been injured in the use of a prone restraint. Staff injuries do occur, however, in the use of other strategies as a behavior is escalating up to the point of initiating a prone restraint. However, I want to impress upon you that even with this commitment of training in our district and our goal to reduce the use of prone restraint, there are times with a limited number of students when the only strategy available to keep a student or others safe is the use of a prone. Along with the other intermediate superintendents, we have testified often with this body over the last 5 years about the extreme behaviors we are seeing with the student population being enrolled in our programs. In fact, we've all had experience of students being dismissed from day treatment programs because they are too violent. We've had experience of students being dismissed from residential treatment programs because they are too violent for that environment. But they're still students, they belong in schools, and so we are serving them. Do we use a prone whenever there is a physical threat for aggression? And the answer to that is no. So I thought it would be helpful to you to describe two real student scenarios, one where we did not use a prone restraint and one where we felt it was needed for safety. The first one, we have a 16-year-old student with autism and very limited verbal skills. He came to us because he was physically aggressive toward others. He was destroying walls in his other environment, and he had a severe obsessive-compulsive disorder. Despite our other successful interventions, including having a separate learning space with indestructible walls, one-on-one instruction, and a positive behavior management plan, there was an incident while being transported alone in a van. The student became extremely agitated, and the trigger was unknown. And during this time period, he completely ripped apart the inside of the van that he was riding in. Given he was not in the vicinity of others who could have gotten hurt, and he was not harming himself, the staff waited. The staff called the police, and the police transported the student to the hospital. Now contrast this with a different story. In this second student incident, the student demonstrated self-harmful behaviors that included very serious headbanging. The student had been given directions to begin working, but instead he became agitated. His behaviors escalated to throwing objects at others and tipping over his desk. These behaviors led to a series of proactive interventions by our staff to try to de-escalate the behaviors. The strategies were unsuccessful. The student became physically aggressive towards staff by kicking and punching. Staff safety and the safety of others in the vicinity were at serious risk, and it was determined that an emergency was underway and an emergency intervention was needed. Moving him to an area of seclusion was not an option because the student continued to bang his head on the wall and injure himself. The use of vertical restraint was unsuccessful due to the size and the strength of the student. So the only emergency method that kept this student and the staff safe was the use of a prone, which was done without harm to the student or the staff. His behavior finally de-escalated after less than 5 minutes, during which time prone was used intermittently. There are very few students that require a prone restraint as an emergency procedure, and there are a very small number of cases where we already know that a different type of emergency procedure cannot be used or does not work to keep the students safe. Prone restraint in our district, as you've heard, is not our first intervention. It is only used when an emergency is underway and only for the safety of the student, other students, and our staff. Right now, without the opportunity to assist a student to de-escalate with a prone, when a serious emergency is underway, would greatly compromise the safety of staff and students in our district. This bill includes allowance for the use of prone for an additional 2 years in our schools. And the intermediate school districts, I'm speaking on behalf of my other two superintendent colleagues, we hope you will support that. But we hope the legislature will also support the recommendations of our work group, our educators and advocates, in that report that we prepared, because it will help us to reduce the use of all restrictive procedures, including prone restraint. There are a number of bills. I know many of you have heard them, including expansion of school-linked mental health grants, which would provide greater access around the state of Minnesota. And we feel this will minimize the use of need for restrictive procedures for students who are experiencing serious mental illness as well as a disability. This bill, among others, sets the stage for earlier intervention for students and families, and we believe will decrease the use over time. This is the goal of every member of the work group that I participated on. Thank you very much for the opportunity to provide testimony today, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Senators, do you have any questions? Senator, I have two other names included in my list as testifiers. I don't know if you would like to entertain questions now.
We'll
give you.
I'll
call you in a minute, Senator Jones. Senator, would you like to entertain questions now?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Clausen or whoever, are school counselors required to be trained in this procedure?
I'm sorry, Senator. Could you repeat that, please?
Yes, Senator Clausen. Are school counselors required to be trained in this procedure, given that they would they would probably be called when there is some altercation in the school.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, I think it would very much depend upon the size of the school. In the school where I was principal, over 2,000 students, we would not be calling upon counselors in that role. It would be more confined to teachers that are in the special needs area and would not be a counselor's role. Now, I could be wrong in saying that in a smaller setting where perhaps there's only one or two counselors in the building. And but in my situation, no, we would not expect a counselor to be in the role of a special needs classroom. And I would guess that would be the case in most buildings in our state.
Madam Chair, and I'm just trying to figure out, like, I understand 916, where you're dealing with many students who have special needs. But in a regular school, even in an elementary school, where things happen in a classroom, who makes a decision? How does it go? That's what I'm asking.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, that would be a decision initially that would be the people in the area. Most likely the teacher would be called upon to make that decision. That teacher may call upon others for assistance in the process. Usually special needs classrooms, there's usually some paraprofessionals as well that may be called to assist. And these were the people that really need the type of training that we're talking about here in the bill 1083.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator. You have a testifier who wishes to.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Valerie Dolson, and I represent the intermediate school districts. And I just wanted to direct you to page 3, lines 7 through 12. It outlines specifically who is able to use restrictive procedures. It's a licensed special ed teacher, school social worker, school psychologist, behavioral analyst certified by the National Behavior Analyst Certification Board, a person with a master's degree in behavior analysis, or other licensed ed professional or paraprofessional who has completed the training program under Subdivision 5.
So, Ms. Doslin, is no requirement for anybody else outside of that group that is actually trained to do this procedure? Thank
Correct,
you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions, members? Any further testimony, Senator, that you wish to call? If not, I think we're ready to move your bill.
Yes, there may be additional testifiers.
Yes. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Elaine Keefe, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, and we do support the bill as amended. Two members of our coalition did serve on the stakeholder group that developed this legislation, and we think they produced some excellent recommendations. I do need to say that we're among the groups that were mentioned by earlier testifiers that do oppose the use of prone restraint, and we would like to see it discontinued as soon as possible. In the task force report, which I don't imagine you've read, it's rather thick, it does note that four organizations represented on the task force, those were the Pacer Center, the ARC of Minnesota, the Autism Society, and the Disability Law Center, did submit a letter stating that we strongly oppose the use of prone restraint as a behavioral intervention and believe it should be discontinued by state law. We support the stakeholder group's other proposed legislative changes to reduce restrictive procedures and support the targeted funding toward this goal. Although our coalition strongly supports a ban on prone restraint, we have agreed to the compromise to allow it to continue for 2 more years. The funding in this bill for training and alternatives to prone restraint is crucial to making this work. And so we hope that those of you who sit on the Finance Committee will give that strong consideration when this bill arrives in that committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Keefe. Mr. Anderson, or please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Mark Anderson. I'm executive director of Barbara Schneider Foundation. On June 12, 2000, Barbara Schneider died in a deadly force encounter with law enforcement when she was in mental health crisis. She was a 50-year-old lady, weighed about 100 pounds, two master's degrees, was a cancer survivor, and lived alone in an apartment in the uptown area in South Minneapolis. She had experienced onset of her mental illness when she was in college. At that time, June 12, 2000, I was working with Senator Wellstone's office on mental health parity, national health insurance, human rights issues. And from the beginning, I worked with a group of community members who responded to her death and with law enforcement to bring the CIT, Crisis Intervention Team, model of de-escalation and cross-system collaboration to Minnesota. What I've seen in those 13 years of work, training and collaborating with police, corrections, hospital emergency department, and behavioral health care nurses, social workers, educators, and others, is that de-escalating a crisis situation is possible with verbal and nonverbal techniques. Elimination of seclusion and restraints is possible. De-escalation is safer for responders and the person being responded to than going hands-on. It improves short-term and long-term outcomes. De-escalation must be adopted as a policy by the institution that's implementing it to provide the support for the staff who do the actual responding. And de-escalation training is relatively simple yet yields dramatic results. I'm here today because prone restraints are not being taught by EMS because they're dangerous with risk of asphyxiation. As you know, EMS is used to crisis response and is connected to the medical system. They're not teaching it. Hospitals are now phasing out and eliminating the use of seclusion and restraints. Department of Human Services is rewriting Rule 40 to end their use by all their providers. Even jails and police are moving in this direction. Our schools should be going in this direction as well. Extreme behavior has a cause, usually a mental illness, often trauma, chronic stress. We need to address the underlying causes, not the symptom. The behavior is the symptom. We need to address the cause. Use of force is part of a punitive approach that adds to the trauma, reduces trust in adults, sets back recovery for months or years for the person that's responded to with these use of force techniques. It leads down the road to juvenile justice contact and adult criminal justice contact. A child needs our help to learn to cope with the feelings they're having that are causing this extreme behavior. If a child doesn't succeed in school, what are the chances they'll succeed in life? Nearly half of the 1,756 documented uses of prone in Minnesota last year were on children of color, mostly boys. These children need our help and support. Eliminating prone restraints and strengthening our capacity for de-escalation will enhance safety for school staff and these children, and it will improve outcomes for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Actually, I know some of you because
you.
I was
if you
on
could
the
please,
school.
Introduce yourself.
I am Renee Jensen. I work with the Barbara Schneider Foundation.
Thank you.
Actually, I know some of you because I was on the school board in White Bear Lake and I ran for state senate in 1996. At the time that I ran for state senate, I started feeling sick. I got very sick after my race. I thought I had the flu. It lasted a long time. I wasn't getting rid of it. I started going to the doctor. In the year 2000, I was finally diagnosed with bipolar disorder. At the time I was diagnosed, I knew I was going to die. I knew I was going to die either from the mania or from the depression. By the year 2004, I was starting to recover, pretty much in recovery, had somewhat stabilized, and I was living by myself in St. Paul. I was concerned because if I had a mental health crisis, I didn't know if the people that we responded to the 911 call knew how to handle a mental health crisis. I knew that there wasn't any training for the law enforcement in my community, so I joined the Mental Health Advisory Council in my in Ramsey County, and I started to push for crisis intervention team training in our county. I got the sheriff and the head of the Department of Human Services, and I contacted Mark Anderson, who I knew was working in crisis intervention team together. And we started working on crisis intervention team in Ramsey County. Now Ramsey County has a very strong crisis intervention team program going. I have two sons with Asperger's syndrome. I have a daughter with depression and chemical dependency, and I have a grandson with Asperger's syndrome. I know what it's like to raise a child with mental health disorders. I know what it's like to look for a school that doesn't use restraints and seclusion. I know what restraints and seclusion does. I've always had bipolar disorder. I know what it's like growing up in schools that punish you for the symptoms of your illness and don't understand the symptoms of your illness and can't understand that you're acting bad or that you're just acting a certain way because of something has triggered your illness, the symptoms of your illness. So I started working with the Barbara Snyder Foundation about 2004. I knew that their training for first responders worked. I had seen it work. I had seen it work with law enforcement. I'd seen it work with social services. I'd seen it work with healthcare providers. I'd seen it work in so many cases, and I'd heard so many stories from the first responders. I'd even seen it work with my own children and with my grandchild. The majority of the people that work with the Barbara Snyder Foundation have either mental illness or are a family member, have a family member with mental illness. But they also are people that are first responders. They also are people that are mental health professionals. They also are educators. They also are social service providers. They also are some type of professional that works with people that have mental illness. So we are people that know that this intervention works. We know that there is a different way of doing things. My grandson goes to a school of people that the other kids all have mental illnesses. They all have some type of health disorder, disability, whatever. They don't use restraints or seclusion. That is not the way they do business there. So what I'm trying to say is you don't have to use prone restraints. I am totally against prone restraints. It traumatizes kids. It sets back their recovery. It is unsafe for them. It can hurt them. It can hurt the person that is responding. It doesn't. It is a terrible thing. When I got sick, I had to go back and deal with all that trauma that I experienced when I was a kid. Those times when people were punishing me for my illness, I had to deal with all that trauma and go through it and get rid of it. That's not what we want for our kids. We want to take care of them. We want them to recover. You can't recover if you're continually traumatizing them. So I want to get rid of the prone restraints. I'd like to get rid of all the restraints. But I know that's not politically possible at this point in time, but we do need to teach our educators how to use verbal and nonverbal restrictions or I don't like the use of restraining them in rooms, but we have to help them learn effective verbal and nonverbal restraints. And also, we have to teach them how to understand what's happening with our kids. So,
thank you, Ms. Johnson.
So that's what we have to. This bill should not have the prone restraints in it at all.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. We really appreciate your testimony, and thank you for sharing with us your experiences. And I think this is so important that we hear your testimony, and it makes it much more real when we hear from individuals who've gone through this journey and whose children have gone through this journey, and they are here to voice those concerns. So thank you so much to both of you. Senator Clausen, any additional testifiers that you know are here that we need to hear from?
I do not believe so, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Senator, if not, we're ready to move your bill as amended.
Madam Chair, at your desire, where do you see this bill going?
This is going to finance, Senator.
Okay. Very good. Madam Chair, I move the approval of Senate File 1083 and referral to finance.
Thank you. Senator Clausen recommends that we move Senate File 1083 and be re-referred to finance. All of those, and Senator Wigger.
Yes. Madam Chair, there's a summary data provision at 6.12 through 14, and I don't know if it's necessary to go to judiciary, but perhaps the author could, check with Senator Latz on that.
Thank you. So let's make sure that we clear that stop, and then for now we're going to refer it to finance unless we hear from Senator Latz. From, I think Ms. Abderholden is saying that it doesn't need to. If you could approach the table. Ms. Abderholden, if you could offer some clarification for Senator Wigger's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. They have done summary data already for this year, so this is actually just kind of continuing that work. So it's nothing new other than they're going to continue to do it.
So it's no additional requirement. Thank you for that clarification. Thank you, Senator. Any other questions, members? On that motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Members, next we have a bill presented by our chair, Senator Torres Ray, Senate File 711.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I'm here to ask for your support to move Senate File 711. 711 is a bill that you have heard about. We have had multiple presentations and recommendations about what to do with our integration policy, our integration revenue, how we should handle the future of some of the programs that have been funded in the past through these initiatives, and many recommendations have been made to this committee, to the Senate, the House. We have multiple reports that have been put in place by community groups. The task force came here to present their recommendations, and we had a hearing that as you recall, was, an extensive hearing to really go over the recommendations of the task force. We also have a report that came out of the auditor's office, for which we also had ample opportunity to review. So this particular bill, members, is really a compilation of those ideas, try to kind of bring all of that together to put a new plan, a new program for the Department for the state of Minnesota. But before I move this bill, Madam Chair, I have I have an amendment, and I have a verbal clarification, just because I caught a term that I could not find a definition for, and I think it's important that we put in legislation terms that we actually understand.
Okay, Senator Torres-Rae, you have the A1 amendment. That is yours, correct?
That is correct. So, Madam Chair, the A1 amendment is basically an effort to give priority in terms of funding for methods that are actually effective and that have been measured. We talk a lot about, you know, the achievement gap, reducing disparities, achievement, achieving inequality. But I think what we're not saying is that there are some districts who are moving in that direction, who have adopted practices who are moving in that direction, and we need to hear from them, and we need to really provide some incentives so that they can come to us and we can begin to talk about best practices. So that's on page 3, line 25. And then the same amendment, in the same amendment, I have page 3, line 34, after must insert report to the commissioner the reasons why the goals were not met. And members, the reason I adopted this language is I would like to recommend that we adopt this language is because we have kind of these very extreme measures that says, you know, you put a plan, and then if you don't complete that plan within 2 years, then you don't receive the funding. Having worked on cultural competency for over 20 years and having worked with disparities and really understanding how disparities are so prevalent in Minnesota, I understand that 2 years may be a very short period of time for districts to really acquire the funding, put together a plan, build the collaboration within the institutions that, you know, are ready to work and other schools. 2 years can go really, really fast. So it could be that a plan is working, but they haven't met the goals. And that's, you know, that could very well happen, that they are on the way. And I would like to provide an opportunity for those districts to go to the commissioner and say, you know, we are getting there. The plan is in place. It has been adopted. It's moving in the right direction. And we feel that within a year or two, we will be there.
Senator,
so we're giving the districts a little bit more time. And then if not, then they no longer have access to the funding.
Senator, you mentioned something about a verbal amendment. Is it in this amendment or is it in
actually,
the bill?
Actually, it's not. So if you would, Madam Chair, if you could help me move the A1 amendment, then I will move into the oral amendment.
Senator Torres-Rae moves the amendment A1 to House File 711, or Senate File 711, excuse me. Any questions? If not, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
I don't know.
Amendment adopted, I should say. And then you wanted to talk about
I think Senator Peterson had a question on the amendment. I don't know.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres-Rae, on the amendment, I see the priority for funding. That's looks like really good language. I just am curious how the mechanics of the prioritization works out. Is it just a general direction to the commissioner, or what does priority exactly mean?
Senator Torres-Rae.
Thank you, Senator. One of the issues that I think we may see or we may encounter is that we don't have sufficient funding to provide to all the districts. It's one issue. Another one is that a district may no longer be eligible, and we have that pot of money available. And so those districts that are actually doing the good work will have access to that money that other districts actually did not use. So eventually I think what we're going to see is a little bit of movement in this fund where we have more or less dollars available. And so part of the effort here is to make sure that we give the commissioner some direction to really look for those districts that are actually making progress.
Okay.
Senator Torres-Rae, you talked Thank
about
you. A verbal amendment.
And members, as I was reading again this bill for about the 20th time, on line 21, there's a term that I believe the House adopted, which is cultural fluency. I do not know what that means in pedagogy. There is no such thing as cultural fluency. So if with your indulgence, I would like to leave it there because I would like to do more engage into a further conversation with the House to see how they see it. But what I would like to do is add some language in there that actually speaks to the cultural terminology that we use in pedagogy, which is cross-cultural interactivity, comma, communication, and pedagogy. So the amendment will read cultural fluency, comma, cross-cultural interactivity, comma, communication, and pedagogy. So when we talk about cultural issues, you know, we really need to attach it to education. It cannot be this fluid term that says, you know, kind of you engage in cultural diversity and cultural competency, cultural competent education without really using the terminology that we use in pedagogy. So that is my oral amendment, Madam Chair.
Members, the council will read back the amendment for you.
Madam Chair, members, page 2, line 1, after the comma insert, cross-cultural interactivity, comma, communication, and pedagogy, comma.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Rey, that is your amendment. Does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask regarding this verbal amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Amendment adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
We'll find out what it means in a while, right?
Members, you know, some of the issues around cross-cultural competency are complex in a sense that they have been defined within the last, you know, 5-10 years. And when we talk about, you know, kind of multicultural work, cultural competent work, and cross-cultural work, really cross-cultural is a broader term that applies to kind of the knowledge of all cultures bringing together, you know, the knowledge around not just race, ethnicity, and culture, but gender. You know, it's much more of a broader term that can be applied to many contexts related to culture. So I thought that was more appropriate. But with respect to the bill, Madam Chair and members, Senate File 711 is really an attempt to bring some very specific concepts about that address integration and address you know, some of the problems that we have in terms of promoting academic achievement within certain groups. As you know, we have really some statistics that you have reviewed time and time again that we're not very proud of. I asked my staff to compile, you know, the latest statistics about graduation rates, and the latest year I have is 2011. And what we have is that only 42% of Indian children are graduating from high school in Minnesota. Only 49%, which, you know, these statistics are higher than they used to be. 47% was the number. Only 49%, which is half of the number of black students who go through our school system, are actually graduating. 51%, which is an increase of 4% for Hispanic children. So half of our Latino children are graduating. And that's compared to 87% of white children that are graduating in Minnesota. So the questions that we have been asking ourselves for the last few years with respect to integration is whether or not we need to continue to talk about providing incentives to districts to address these disparities within the context of race, ethnicity, and culture. And I think these statistics are pretty compelling, and the answer is yes. With time, and I very much hope that I'm ready to present that before the Committee on Finance, where we need to talk more about, you know, really the argument for financing this kind of approach. What we see in Minnesota is that there are some districts in which we have high incidence of poverty, in which we do not see these statistics. So in trying to really break apart the whole argument of income and race and ethnicity in Minnesota. Minnesota presents a very unique case in a sense that we have a very high graduation rate for a community, a state that is predominantly white, and we have a significant problem with students who are of a different race. And in the we have actually been able to provide ample documentation in the last 12-15 years for three specific groups, and that they are Native American, Black, and Hispanic Latino. So those are the two for which we have significant statistical information that shows that where in these communities we have high incidence of poverty, we also have a tremendous achievement gap, and where the rates of graduation and academic attainment is actually very low. So the bill before you has the very specific components. Number one, it establishes a program that very specifically provides language for how this program should work to really close the achievement gap, what the bill calls the achievement and opportunity gap. I am not necessarily crazy about that term, if you ask me. So the bill provides what the program does, which is to serve students from different racial and ethnic and economic backgrounds, taking into account geographic and demographic particularities affecting the students, the districts, and to provide for, kind of the race, the neighborhood location, and characteristics, grades, socioeconomic status, academic performance, and language barriers. So it's very specific about the actual elements that are included. The bill also included a description of who is eligible to apply for these dollars. The bill also includes a description of the different components that will be funded if they are included in a plan that is submitted by a district. And it does very specifically say that it should include innovative and integrative pre-kinder to grade 12 learning environments that offer students choices, family engagement, involve families in the students' academic life and success, provides for professional development opportunities, increase programmatic opportunities that focus on rigor and college and career readiness. So this is something that it didn't exist before, so we're talking about really having very specific plans to address academic performance and to provide academic support for children pre-K all the way to grade 12 and high school, and is very specific in the language. The bill also offers something very important and different, which we typically don't do in education, which is in Subdivision 3, it talks about building progress and performance, and really coming to us to let us know, to come to the commissioner to let her know, you know, how are they making progress, and then providing for longitudinal data that is actually required. So the districts will be responsible for collecting information and bringing that information to the department so that we can measure growth and progress towards proficiency. And I want to make absolutely clear on that is on Section 2 of Subdivision B, which talks about student growth and progress towards proficiency in reading and math as defined in statute. So it's very clear about what we're measuring here, which is academic growth. Then Subdivision 4 calls for an evaluation, which is also a really important issue. These are additional dollars that we are providing, and we want to be very specific about what is that we want these districts to accomplish. And that is clearly defined in statute. So in Section 2, we also talk about eligibility and achievement and integration revenue and how it will be distributed amongst the districts. And then Subdivision 3, it defines, it specifically looks into the 70% and in the subsequent subdivisions actually include language that was put together for the recommendations for the task force. And as you remember, the department actually worked on a formula that apparently is much more effective and has been well-reviewed, and I believe they are here to speak about that issue. So the actual formula was the formula that was recommended by the department, and the distribution, you know, I will be happy to call the department to talk about this. We will present that in Senator Wieger's committee with in length. So basically, that's what the bill is, members. And I have several testifiers who were not able to testify when we presented, you know, the recommendations of the task force, who are here and wish to speak to you about the bill.
So shall we take those testifiers right now and be sure that they get in their information?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate
it. Mr. Negsted and Shauna Ugla Baju. How's that? Oh, I'm sorry.
How are you?
I didn't realize. Okay. I thought these are the only two.
Okay.
Go ahead. Mr. Erickson, would you like to have him first? Senator Torres Ray?
No, you're here. Just go ahead. It's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Lars Negsted. I'm here representing Isaiah. Isaiah is a vehicle for people of faith to work together for racial and economic equity in Minnesota. I'm here in place of my colleague Phyllis Hill, who's ill today, unfortunately. So first of all, let me just say that as people of faith, we believe that God commands us to love one another and to love our neighbor. We believe that children ought to be at the center of all our public policies, especially our education policy. And if we do that, if we place children at the center, then we will be on a path towards creating health, wholeness, and prosperity for everyone. Isaiah leaders followed very closely the Integration Replacement Revenue Task Force last year, and we were impressed how that task force came together on a bipartisan basis to formulate a set of recommendations, and we hope you will emulate that process and come together to pass this Achievement and Integration for Minnesota plan. We believe that integration is one crucial strategy to achieve equity in education. We know that history shows and courts have ruled that separate is inherently unequal. Integration, we believe, can't be achieved without resources, without accountability, and without a regional approach. And we think that this bill makes progress in that direction. Public education to us is a cornerstone of our democracy. We believe integration and the pursuit of equity is not a social experiment, but is a moral imperative. Integration is the means by which our fates become intertwined. Without steps to promote and protect integration, children of color will continue to be denied the opportunity for success, and we can't afford that as a state. Thank you for your attention this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Shall we proceed with the testifiers, or would you like to?
Yes. Yes, go ahead, Senator.
Senator Chamberlain has a question for you, sir. Maybe yes. For
yeah.
You.
Yeah, just a quick question. Mr. Larson, thank you for coming by. I was reviewing this, as you might. I'd just like your opinion on the previous integration project we had in the state of Minnesota. You know, a couple of years ago we had the debate on this, and the reason it was repealed was because it had, in our opinion, had failed. What was your opinion of that previous integration effort? Because it was designed to close the achievement gap.
Mr. Negsted.
Well, I think, first of all, I'd say I'm not an expert in all the ins and outs. I do think that the previous effort was about more than closing the achievement gap. We believe that the achievement gap is an enormous problem. We prefer to refer to it as an opportunity gap, and there's many causes and many factors involved in that. We think that as our state rapidly diversifies, we all have an interest in making sure that children of color can succeed in education. We believe they can learn, and we need to prove that we believe they can learn by putting the resources there and the programs in place to show that. I think that generally we feel that this is a step forward in terms of some accountability and some standards. We think it's one strategy towards creating racial equity in our state. We don't think it's sufficient, frankly. We think it needs to go beyond this. But we wholeheartedly support this bill and hope you will as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Erickson, Mr. Bob Erickson. Welcome, Mr. Erickson. Identify yourself, please.
Thank you for the opportunity to appear once again before the committee. My name is Bob Erickson, member of the Lakeville Area Public School Board of Education in my second term. Also representing today the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, where I serve on the legislative committee, and also speak on behalf of the 131 districts that are served by integration revenue currently, representing 172,685 students statewide. Again, thanks for this opportunity, and I want to thank Senator Torres Ray for authoring Senate File 711, now as amended. Very quickly, in the interest of time, your time is valuable. I just want to indicate that the Association of Metropolitan School District represents 50% of the students enrolled in public schools in the state of Minnesota. That's 38 districts, three of which are integration districts. Our legislative platform places a great emphasis on the create integrated and equitable learning environments. A member of the task force, a 12-member task force, which convened their work in October of 2011 and completed their work on February 14, 2012, and submitted our recommendations to the commissioner, which was then submitted onto the legislature for your consideration at this time. What prompted the creation of the task force was the legislative audit in November of 2005, which was frankly very critical of the program and in large measure indicated that the program lacked accountability, something that Senator Torres Ray today referenced explicitly and defined what is in the bill that would change the course of history and meet the expectations of not only the legislative committee, but now the work of the task force. As you heard, we 12-member task force, six of whom were appointed by the governor and commissioner, and six were appointed by Senate Republican leadership and or the House Speaker at the time of its creation under statutory authority. In the end, the work that we did included, I heard Isaiah's comments today, they were one of 41 groups that we received presentations from, 41 different groups. The task force recommendations are very clear. We want to create the Achievement and Integration for Minnesota program, AIM, and we're not requesting any additional funding beyond what has been previously allocated by the legislature. And that dollar amount is $68 million, again, serving 131 school districts, serving 172,000-plus students. That number, by the way, is provided by Dr. Melcher within the last 10 days. That is the number of students that are being served by the integration and equity funding. The oversight at the Minnesota Department of Education was also referenced in detail by the author, Senator Torres Ray. Our recommendations is that we want innovative, integrated learning environments. We want family engagement, professional development, access to opportunity, and increase the diversity of our teachers and administrators. Very quickly, with regard to the fiscal principles of our recommendation, we were not asking for additional funding over what was previously provided by the legislature. I will indicate, however, that there's a sunset, and in the absence of your action to fund this through the Finance Committee, ultimately House and Senate, and then ultimately onto the omnibus, absent action by the current legislature, the program loses its standing and it ends through a sunset provision previously enacted by a former legislature. The total dollar expenditure for integration and equity statewide is $100 million. 70%, or approximately $68 million, is provided by the state of Minnesota. 30%, I want to emphasize, 30% currently is provided through a local levy adopted by each individual school district through a public hearing process. Right now, that provision of 30% local levy is not included in the governor's legislation or an omnibus education bill, and is soon to end, first for Minneapolis and St. Paul at the end of this school year, and then for the remaining 129 school district, it would end for the school district of 13, at the end of 13-14. So the local stakeholders who have been embraced the integration equity program, that those dollars would be lost. And that is a grave concern to all parties involved, whether it be the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, whether it be 131 school districts currently receiving those funds. It is of concern. We also would like to just set aside a very small amount of the $68 million, 0.2%, which equates to $200,000 to expand the staffing at the Minnesota Department of Education. That's included in the legislation. I'd be quick to point out that $200,000 would add to the single one only employee Minnesota Department of Education that reviews 131 district budgets. So we're anxious to have a fiscal model that's predictable over time and that is stable and sustainable in 2 year increments. And finally, and I would honestly tell you most importantly, the task force and included in the legislation is that we want 80% of the revenue from the state, 80% of the $68 million to be spent on students in the classroom, and the remaining 20% would be spent on professional development administration. And in no case could administrative costs exceed 10%. I would like to also reference a couple of the programs that have been successful that are funded by integration and equity. And those programs include something I'm very passionate about, which is the AVID program, Advancement Via Individual Determination. It's a college readiness program designed to increase the students who will enroll in 2- and 4-year institutions upon graduation. This is a proven program which closes the achievement gap, and it's been successful in 31 school districts, serving 5,305 students currently. Maybe you've heard about it. It's a tremendous program. In closing, I just want to share with you the changing demographics that have evolved since integration equity was originally funded. When it was originally funded, Minneapolis and St. Paul had the highest percentage of students of color. Today, they represent students of color in Minneapolis and St. Paul represent 70% of their students. But did you know that Columbia Heights, Worthington, Brooklyn Center, and Richfield also exceed 70%? Or were you aware that the following districts exceed 40% students of color? West St. Paul, Burnsville, Bloomington, North St. Paul, Roseville, Onamia, Lynd, Wilmer, Osseo, and Robbinsdale all have enrollments with students of color exceeding 40%. That's just a quick overview of that. Today, I'm real pleased to have with me to make very short presentations to you students from Lakeville South High School. Both have benefited immensely from the funding provided by you, members of the legislature. And you may have seen our AVID newsletter, which we passed out. And the first student I'd like to introduce today to make a very short presentation would be, and I'm going blank here, I apologize for that.
Jamal.
No, we're going to have...
So he's not here?
Yeah, Jamal's here. Okay. But we're going to have...
We can only call two people.
Yes, we have... Sebastian
Lopez.
Lopez will speak first, and okay. He's available, and then followed by Jamal.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome,
thanks,
gentlemen.
Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll start with Sebastian, and I don't know which one of you is Sebastian.
Right here.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Sebastian Lopez. I am currently a sophomore at Lake LaSalle High School. My freshman year in high school was a challenge, to say the least, as first and foremost, I was not a part of the AVID program. And secondly, I struggled academically and finished my year with a C average. I was introduced to AVID my sophomore year, and I am now getting A's and B's. And my goal is to graduate high school summa cum laude and go to Northwestern University located in Evanston, Illinois. I'm so thankful for AVID as it has given me a new perspective on academics and learning how to take Cornell notes, prepare for tests, become a better writer, and work with my AVID tutorials, and I am now very organized. These tools and resources have given me the confidence to tackle my academics with a new dimension. Of the many tools I just described, I would say that my continual learning and application on taking Cornell notes has not only taught me to be organized, structure my notes and thoughts properly, but has also allowed me to retain the subject matter in a way I thought difficult before. Before I obtained the skill of learning how to take Cornell notes, when I was not in AVID, I would write my notes my way and therefore had a challenging time retaining the subject matter when it came time for studying for a test. I'm a testimony to how effective and beneficial the AVID program is. I am living proof that this program is effective. It would be a shame to see other students not benefit from this outstanding program, which is geared to assist underserved populations to reach their dreams of attending college. Thank you again for your support with AVID.
Sebastian, could you tell me and the committee how you got involved or what made you go into AVID? Is there any specific incident?
Well, as I told you in my speech, I was very average my freshman year, getting a C average, and I was looking for some way to get me back on track academically, and I heard about the AVID program from actually my mom. She works in the school district, and she said that AVID is very beneficial to your future. It guides you on the track of going to a four-year or a two-year college. And my mom actually signed me up for AVID. And at first, to be honest, I didn't think it was going to be all that fun and well for me. But as I'm going through this year, it's been very, very, very life-changing for me. It showed me to be a better person myself academically with academic independence. And it's just showed me how we must take advantage of our academics in order to have a bright future.
So your advice is to listen to your mother.
Yeah. Yep.
It's one I would say.
Yep.
Very good. Thank you very much. And Jamal.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jamal Abdullahi, and I am a sophomore at Lakeville South High School, and I have been in AVID since 8th grade. Before I joined AVID, I was becoming less and less motivated to get my work done, and even though I was striving to go to college, I had not seen the big picture. The big picture is that you have to struggle and commit hard work to become successful. AVID has helped in showing me this big picture and has allowed me to gain certain qualities and skills to be successful in college. One skill that I have acquired through AVID is team building. Through our various group projects along with our tutorials, I have learned how to be open with my group, and I learned how to contribute by asking questions and offering ideas to actually participate in the group. Whereas before AVID, I would silently sit and work within the group while not contributing. With the guidance, or another critical skill that I have obtained are leadership skills. AVID has provided me with many successful guest speakers such as Paul Jones and Dr. Cynthia Hayes. who have all told me to be successful, you must be a leader. Avid has made me create leadership goals that I am being held accountable to for the next 2 years. Also, Avid has shown me the importance of goal making to become an important leader and to become successful in college and afterwards in my career. With the guidance of the Avid program, I plan to attend the University of Minnesota and thereafter obtain a degree in medicine and become a successful neurosurgeon. Without the Avid program, I would not be where I am today, and I would be worse off in trying to accomplish my medicinal goal. Avid has taught me to be proactive with my education, not reactive. Overall, the idea of not having this phenomenal program is devastating to me, because I am living proof that this amazing program has been beneficial and one of the main reasons for my continuing success in education. Thank you.
Thank you. You both have very good stories. How about you, Jamal? Where did a teacher guide you, your parents?
Well, actually, in seventh grade, we held a grade meeting in the lecture hall, and we watched a video about how Avid is beneficial to us. So when I went home, I talked to my mom about it, and my sister was already in the program. So me, my older sister, and my younger sister are now in the program, and we're all looking forward to college.
Thank you. Very good. Good wishes to you in the future. Any questions, members? Thank you for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
And now we have Dorothy Bielke and Dave Law. Are you able to get that working?
I'm trying.
Oh, that's the one that was on before.
It's me. Yeah. I think this takes.
Okay. Thank you.
Start and then we'll.
Apologize for that, members and testifiers.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Law. I'm the Assistant Superintendent in the White Bear Lake Area Schools, and we are members of the East Metro Integration District.
And you have the handout that goes with the slides, is that with your?
He doesn't, so we're going to wait until this starts working, so he's going to provide his testimony on the chair.
Thank you. Mr. Law.
Thank you. I'm here, first of all, to tout the fact that White Bear Lake is one of two East Metro districts that has made adequate yearly progress according to No Child Left Behind. I know one of the concerns from this committee are the results that we get through integration funding. As the supervisor of 15 sites and a teaching and learning department, we've benefited from East Metro Integration District for student programming and staff development to help all of our students feel welcome, challenged, and successful in our school district. I can tell you that over the last 6 years, through the integration funding and the work of the East Metro Integration District, that's the primary spot for me to have discussions about closing the achievement gap and successful programming. I have personally experienced the AVID programming that the students before me referenced, and our district is experiencing a closing of the gap in participation and advanced coursework for students of color through the integration funding. If we want to change the workforce in our schools in Minnesota in the future, we need to continue to provide opportunities for students to receive challenge and rigor and get college preparedness. I'm thrilled to participate in this project, and I would hate to see it go for the struggles and the loss in our school system for our students of color. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I'll turn the presentation over to the Northwest Integration School District.
Thank you, Mr. Law. And now we have Ms. Bielke.
Hi, my name is Dorothy Bielke. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Suburban Integration School District. We are one of three of the integration districts in the metropolitan area. Northwest Suburban is made up of eight districts in our collaborative, which include Moundsview, Fridley, Brooklyn Center, Osseo, Rockford, Buffalo, Hanover, Montrose, Elk River, and Anoka Hennepin School. And we have a combined 95,000 students who are served by integration funding. Today in the room with me are Paul Durand. Is Paul Durand the superintendent of Rockford Schools? Scott Thielman, superintendent of Buffalo, Hanover, Montrose Schools. And Teresa Lunt, she's a school board member for the Osseo Area Schools. And we're here today to share with you how we utilize integration funding and show our support for Senate File 711. First, I'd like you to know that we do have a level of accountability at this time, where each March, all eight school districts and Northwest Suburban submit to MDE our plan and budget for integration funding for the next school year. We work together on the same type of goals that you have, which is to increase student achievement and close the achievement gap for our students of color. We also work hard at creating integrative learning environments and provide access to all students for their success beyond high school. One of the main ways that we use integration funding and to create innovative and integrative learning environments with high rigor for all students are our magnet schools. We currently have 22 magnet schools in our eight districts, and they all are run by their local school district. There are three themes that they fall into: the arts, international baccalaureate, and STEM. And enrolled are over 12,500 students, of which 48% of those students are students of color. Just over 4,000 are enrolled through Northwest Suburban through school choice offerings. In other words, they are attending a magnet school that's not their neighborhood designated school. As I said, integration funding is heavily used to support our magnet schools at Northwest Suburban. We coordinate their applications, transportation, quality control, and coordination amongst the magnet schools and program and personnel. The local school districts use integration funding for specialized materials, resources, leadership, and training that is unique to the magnet programming. We want to reiterate what was said earlier, that if the integration levy is allowed to sunset, that we will receive 30% less funding, and that will impact the quality of our magnet programming. As I said, one of our main goals is student achievement, and one way in which we track student achievement is we analyze MCA data over five-year trends by ethnicity and gender. We look for trends that show overall growth and gap closing. We look to identify best practices that can be shared across schools, districts, and our collaborative. And we at Northwest, in addition to superintendents, principals, and magnet personnel, use that data to set goals for program and for program enhancements. I have with in your packet, and it's a little bit bigger later on, so you can see it in a larger format. It's just a sampling of three of our schools and the type of data tracking that we do, so you can get a handle on it. And the first school is Anoka Middle School. It's a 6-8 middle school for the arts in the Anoka Hennepin School District. And this first slide shows their demographic trends over the course of 5 years. You'll see there's four groupings on the chart. The first group is for Anoka Middle School. The second grouping is for the Anoka Hennepin School District. The third grouping is for our whole collaborative, all eight school districts. And the last one is for the state of Minnesota. And you can see that Anoka Middle School has 14% students of color. If you look at the next data point, it's the actual science analysis for Anoka Middle School, which only includes eighth grade, as eighth grade is the only grade that's tested for science at the middle school level. There's lots of data here, and I'm just going to give you a quick little overview of how all the data so you can look at this later on. But there are seven data points, each showing a five-year trend. The first one is for ELL students. The second is for special ed students. The third are for free and reduced lunch students. The fourth is for the whole Anoka Middle School. The fifth is the whole Anoka Hennepin School District. The sixth is for all of Northwest Suburban's collaborative. And the last is for the state of Minnesota. So if we just concentrate on the fourth set of data, you'll see the trends for Anoka Middle School in science for 8th grade. We see a positive growth over time. We see that the subgroups are scoring higher than their district, Northwest Suburban, and the state of Minnesota. And we see that there is progress being made to closing the achievement gap. We look at our next school, which is Fridley Middle School. It's an IB middle school for grades 5 through 8. You can see that they have 42% students of color enrolled in that building. If we look at the...
Excuse me, Ms. Bielke. Did you say 14% in the Anoka Middle School for the Arts?
For students of color?
Students of color.
Yes, I did. Okay. And so, for Fridley Middle School, it's 42%. Okay.
42.
42 for Fridley Middle School.
Okay.
Yeah. This is their reading. So grades 5 through 8 are all tested with the MCA testing. So this is for all 5th through 8th graders. And again, we'll just concentrate on the fourth set of data, which is the whole school, as compared to the last set of data, which is the state of Minnesota. And you can see that, again, there's a general trend up. Gap is being closed, especially with their black students. And most students are scoring higher than the state averages. One more school for you to look at is Monroe Elementary, which is a K-5 STEM school in the Anoka-Hennepin School District. And they have 55% of their students of color. When we look at math, now math is only tested in grades 3 through 5, so that's what this is representing. But if we look at the fourth set of data again, you see that the gap is basically closed, especially amongst the two largest subgroups, which are their Asian and their black students. And all students scored higher than the state averages. Northwest Suburban, as I said, is a collaborative, and our 8 school districts really value the collaborative aspect and take advantage of the programmings that we offer, and it's turned into very cost-effective for many of our districts to take advantage of us because of their small size. Some of the ways that we help support them is through accountability. Each, on a 2-year rotation, all of our magnet schools go through a reflection and a review process that gives them feedback onto their current programming and help establish goals for improvement over the next set of 2-year two-year cycle. All of our IB schools are also held accountable to the IB World Organization. And as I showed you, we track the MCA data for them. We provide program support for students, including AVID, and you heard two wonderful representatives of the AVID program, and they're equally represented in our school districts that have AVID. And we also have a student leadership conference each year that brings 500 students from our collaborative to a 1-day conference to work on their leadership skills and also to practice real-world experiences such as employability. They go through a mock interview. They give public debates. They do lesson plan writing for the Future Educator Club. So it's a wonderful event that's just happening in a couple of weeks. We have professional development that we provide in our school districts, especially for our magnet schools, about magnet programming and bringing the different themes together for collaboration. We also do professional development around our multicultural resources and trainings, especially trainings working from families from all demographics and all backgrounds. We work with family and community engagement. We offer programming for mentoring, such as an after-school mentoring program for latchkey children, which is starting in its... A couple of our programs are now in their second year, and we're really seeing some positive impact on students attending school, having homework done, and improved achievement. We also work with in collaboration with our school districts for parent leadership academies, trying to identify parents from all backgrounds and all representatives in their districts and bring them into school leadership positions. I want to thank you for allowing me to come and speak today. It's really hard to share everything we do in a very short period of time. And I just want to reiterate again that we are very much in support of this bill and do hope that you will allow us to continue to have access to integration funding in the future. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And members, any questions for the testifiers? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So going back to the graphics you had there, and I can't really, to be honest, even in the handout, really make out exactly what is going on with those. Okay, they're on the back page. I understand you pointing out some data points and Is the suggestion then that there's a direct connection because the district receives integration funding and therefore that's why these things are happening?
Yeah, the integration funding is used heavily to support our magnet programming. And so our magnet programming, because it's innovative, it's inclusive, and it's high rigor, they are showing to that gaps are being closed and students of all demographics are dramatically improving in their abilities to be successful in the classroom.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and then the graphic is showing that the magnet schools that receive this assistance are doing better than their districts on the whole. Is that?
That's correct.
What I'm looking at?
Okay.
All right.
Any other questions, members?
Need help.
If not, thank you very much for your information. We have one other person.
Thank you,
listed.
Members. I think, yes, I don't have your agenda, Madam Chair, so I don't
Shauna
know who's next.
Shauna Oglobaju. Pardon me for the pronunciation.
Good afternoon.
And would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair. My name is Shauna Moses Olagbaju.
Olagbaju. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate this opportunity to sit before you all and share some perspective on both personally and professionally concerning the strong supports that would be offered with the passing of the bill that's before us. I serve as the coordinator of educational equity and integration for Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm also a member of the Minnesota School Integration Council, which has a number of equity coordinators and directors who help to move this work forward. And I'm here to testify in favor, in support of this bill. Also, just noting the representation from the more than 30,000 students that are served in Minneapolis, as well, 68% of which are students of color as well, too. I want to, before I kind of dive into the points that I wanted to share with you today, I want you to hear a little bit about what brings me here. I am a first-generation Minnesotan. I'm Louisiana root and Minnesota fruit, okay? The product of African-American parents from Louisiana who came to Minnesota in the mid-1960s in search of opportunities and creating a life that they felt they weren't afforded to thrive in the Deep South. While there are some rich pieces that we still hold on from the South, what was true at that time was some of the loomings and pieces of racism and blocking from opportunities that were present for folks at that time. And so my family came here in search of to provide their kids something that they weren't afforded themselves. And one of those things was real access to job opportunities and certainly a solid foot when it comes to education. They followed relatives who had also come here and were certainly excited to be seriously considered for jobs, to have real opportunities at affordable housing and essentially a place to take root. I'm also a product of Minneapolis Public Schools and a beneficiary of an integrated racial and ethnic and economic educational experience. Having attended a high school in North Minneapolis, led at that time by a principal who advocated for educational equity before we called it that, and who started an international baccalaureate program to mirror some of the experiences that she saw available to students in the southwest end of our district at that time. She held the desire to increase the number of students of color in advanced placed courses. And certainly this was an opportunity that later positioned me to be able to receive a full ride to a Minnesota State College. So what I'm trying to demonstrate to you is how some of the very things that we're describing that this bill could support were benefits that I received in my own journey here. I also come to you with this work as a practitioner in this work, having worked in educational equity in relation to the funds that are supported here for 10 years with experience in first ring suburbs, our second ring suburbs, and now in Minneapolis. So as I move into my testimony, I just want to share three major points. First, I believe that there's a compelling state interest in the creation and establishment of integrated learning environments for all of our students. Certainly, we've heard the national research, we've heard local research that supports the premise that integration benefits the academic attainment of students of color and of white students as well. An example, integrated schools often provide students of color with greater access to information, resources, and informal social networks that then lead to college aspirations, acceptance to college, and attendance, and hopefully graduating as we see these students. We know they'll do that, right? In one study, it mentions that African-American and white students who attend integrated schools are more likely to have friends from a racial group other than their own, more likely to work in integrated workplaces, and more likely to live in integrated neighborhoods. These differences persist even when researchers control for socioeconomic status, by the way, prior achievement, and student location. And finally, I want to share this data point with you, too. Learning in diverse settings, it said, encourages complex and critical thinking. For example, one study found that students in racially and ethnically diverse classrooms showed the greatest engagement in active thinking processes, growth in intellectual engagement, and motivation and growth in intellectual and academic skills. And I think this is certainly something that we desire for all of our students. Second, these recommendations are the result of course, a bipartisan, thoughtful process. The task force recommendations are the fruit from the root of the most thoughtful and inclusive deliberations on integration policy probably in the past 30 years. Consider Minneapolis Public Schools was released from court supervision of our integration plan 30 years ago. Since then, Supreme Court decisions, state rules, and demographic changes across the state have changed the face of integration policy and practice in the state. And this legislation provides a much-needed update to state integration policy and finance that has been named. Third, and others have mentioned this, the current law sunset of integration revenue, while retaining the integration rule and mandate to create opportunities to foster increased interracial contacts and close the achievement gap, places the state in jeopardy. A clearly enunciated mandate, absent any mechanism, invites scrutiny that I'm sure we're ready to move past. The adoption of this bill states a clear policy and finance mechanism in support of integrated learning environments. I do want to mention some as well of the programs that Minneapolis Public School is funding with the use of our integration dollars. Of course, one of our largest recipients of funding is AVID, as you've heard about. But in addition to that, I want to highlight some of the pieces around professional development that this funding allows us to provide our teachers. One is the Teachers Institute of Cultural Development and Focus Instruction. It's a 2-year professional development opportunity afforded to our teachers, given to them, that allows them ongoing coaching, to develop within a community of their learners, and also to receive information and best practices in terms of strategy, of closing the achievement gap, all in the context of their particular content area. What do I mean? So a math teacher then is able to receive information about intercultural development in the context of his or her math area. And so you can see how it leads certainly to a much more intentional inclusion of those strategies within the classroom then. Another example would be some of the work that we're doing with the National Equity Project, who is facilitating educational leadership trainings for our leadership team. meaning cabinet and others. And then through them, they also provide something called teaching with a cultural eye that, again, helps to influence our classrooms. We found that there is repeated need and desire for development in that area by our teachers, and these funds allow us to support that. I also want to mention that as we think about the idea of accountability and how do we be very intentional and show progress with having these funds, with using these funds, we've developed an integration revenue program report. We've tweaked it and tweaked it and tweaked it. And I believe that based on the recommendations from the task force, that it gave us an idea of how we could strengthen that. These program reports not only capture the goals, the strategies, implementation plan of each program receiving the funding, but also it requests those metrics that are used and what are the program outcomes. This is the first year of this final tweak that we'll be doing. The part that I think is most useful is that it looks at how, it asks the question, how has this program advanced Minneapolis public schools and the state of Minnesota's integration and desegregation goals? What are the successes? What are the promising practices? What are the case studies and what are the challenges? So in hearing more about that expectation of bringing then what's working back to our commissioner, I think this gives us an excellent opportunity to do that. So finally, we believe that the integration rule certainly, in closing, we urge you, of course, to pass this bill and look forward to partnering. We don't believe that all things are perfect, but we certainly believe that this is a state with growing diversity, right, and that we should actually spend more revenue, perhaps, in the future to support more school districts adequately addressing a more diverse student body. We believe a comprehensive integration policy must address housing as the key lever to reduce segregation. The Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan region is certainly one of the most racially segregated regions in the country, and we see the impact of that certainly in our district, having nearly 70% students of color. The past 30 years certainly have proven that school integration policy, absent meaningful housing integration policy, is inadequate to the task. However, we note that current law policy, which relies on choice to achieve integrated schools, results in single race and ethnic schools as often as it produces integrated schools. We believe the integration rule must also be updated to reflect current demographic and legal realities. So this would be something in developing as we look forward ahead that we could certainly look at. However, this certainly presents a first step on a long journey towards greater equity for all in our society, and it seems that this would be a right step on the journey to raise the achievement of all of our Minnesota students while disrupting the racial predictability of achievement. So today would be a great day to start that journey together. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, member?
Thank you very much.
Great. If not, Senator Torres Ray, do you have any comments or?
Thank you, no. Madam Chair and members.
Excuse me, Madam.
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there may be confusion over whether it was questions for the testifier or questions for the author.
Okay.
We're done with testimony now.
As far as I have been notified, unless there's anyone in the audience that wishes to come forward regarding this topic. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres Ray, I'm start at the top. I've got a number of questions. I'm not sure that there's adequate time to address all the questions from the committee here, but I'll start with one of the goals and one of the stated goals in the past. I worked closely with Representative Mariani as well and in the House, and talking about cultural competency for teachers and a diverse racial makeup of educators in the especially in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but overall, I mean, what's it, 3.5% of our educators are of color, while a much higher, exponentially higher number of our students are of color. So anyways, my question gets at There's a stated goal in here, I think on line 2.16, 2.17, to recruit and retain teachers with diverse backgrounds. And I'm just curious how you plan to actually go about doing that. As you know, Senator Torres Ray, the current statute, the Tenure Act, the Continuing Contract Law, really defines exactly what you can do to retain teachers, to performance manage teachers, et cetera. So how do you go about doing that, introducing a significant number of teachers that are of diverse backgrounds, while recognizing the fact that current statute maybe has some natural barriers to accomplishing that?
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Senator, for that question. There is an implicit kind of issue with respect to recruiting people from diverse backgrounds and what that means. And I think that more and more we are seeing that clearly we need to make a better effort on recruiting, you know, teachers and administration that reflects, you know, the race and ethnicity of the children that are being served. A challenge for a district like my district, where 69% of children are, you know, Native American, Latino, and we don't have the teachers. When we make a requirement, I think that what we do is actually provide that kind of push to say, you know, you must look for these groups. You must review applications. You must, you know, take into account the backgrounds of these individuals. But it's not unique to race and ethnicity, and I want to make that clear, that we have a number of teachers, a number of individuals who are really beginning to get more instruction and learning about what it means to teach, you know, in an urban setting, what it means to teach immigrant children to learn language. We have a lot of different teachers who are really beginning to explore, multicultural training and exchange programs, who travel to different countries to really obtain skills. So diverse backgrounds don't necessarily equate to race and ethnicity anymore, but the capacity of an individual to work cross-culturally. And people, we have a lot of young students who are coming to the field, who actually are traveling abroad. I mean, this generation, you know, of the 20-somethings that are traveling all over the planet to really acquire these skills, because not only they feel that these cross-cultural skills are needed in education, but in companies who really are recruiting these kind of individuals. So the diverse background is really a background that is required to perform in our society today, and I think young students really understand what that is. So I think we're moving in that direction, not just in education, but, you know, in private sector and everywhere, that we're beginning to really understand what that means and what we are requiring people to do.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up on that. And I agree with actually most of the points you made. I think what I'm trying to get at, though, is more some of the impediments within current law that may, for example, I'll point out an example. If Minneapolis or St. Paul or any school district, for that matter, were to recruit a large number of these individuals into the teaching ranks, current law would state that, and especially over the last 10 years, a high number of those teachers within their first year would be laid off due to teacher retention policies that are centered around seniority. And so if you're do you agree that districts should be able to have the flexibility to maybe live up to some of the mission statement, if you will, of integration, and maybe being able to work around some of those current labor laws that I think, and I know other people within the minority community in particular, believe as a natural barrier to entry for people who are trying to get into the profession in these districts. And as you know, there have been thousands of teachers who have been laid off, not only due to funding issues, but also declining enrollment, school mergers, and the like. What I'm saying is some of our current policies can actually work against the stated goal of bringing in a diverse new set of teaching candidates.
You know, Senator, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Torres-Ray.
It's a very It's a very difficult question, I think. What we know is that there are a lot of teachers who are retiring, and I know that there is a tremendous desire within these districts to really recruit individuals, you know, with different talents and energy, people who have these broad experiences, who have, you know, lived in these communities, who have experienced different things. I think that is the trend. So to say that perhaps we need to be, more proactive or have legislative direction, to redirect the districts to take into account the union hiring and to review the whole issue of seniority. It's a different conversation. I think what we're doing with this legislation is saying that we look for people with those backgrounds, people who can be effective in the classroom, who know the experience of a child, who have lived the experience of a child, who understand where that child comes from, and that with that element of that training, they will be, you know, capable of really helping those children, move forward and acquire kind of the academic growth that is necessary to be effective, to succeed in our school system. And so I think that is happening. I say it from
Senator
my own district.
Senator Torres-Ray, the bill that we heard today in E-12 committee, Senator Dietzick brought it forward, Senate File 808, thanks to staff who told me the number of it, about the recruitment and education of for teachers of color, because as far as I know, that is a very difficult group of people to find teachers that are trained right now. So I think we are looking at ways to provide the pool of candidate teachers that we can then replace, put into place when they're needed, and they're going to be needed much more as time goes on. Hopefully we'll be recruiting out of our schools for candidates to go for teaching. So
that's right, Madam Chair. I hope you're right.
Senator Peterson, are you finished with your question? Would you like to?
Sure.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, thank you for bringing this to us. I know you've given it a lot of thought. And I was, as you were presenting your bill and I was listening to the testifiers, I was thinking about the OLA report on integration aid. And I know it was in 2005, but we also had the auditor come back and talk about how things had not changed as of last year. And so I was looking for what I saw in that OLA report. Specifically, the general theme was there needed to be more focus and oversight. And so that's what I was looking for in your bill. And I see some improvement there. And I also have a couple questions. On lines 1.13, you talk about, the bill talks about economic integration. And it mentions it again on 2.19 and 2.34. And with the OLA recommendations in my mind about being more focused and oversight, I'm just not sure what economic integration means. And what do you mean by that? What's kind of describe that for me? What's that look like in the school system?
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on your first question, Senator, with respect to the oversight, for me, it has been the last few weeks has been a tremendous, awakening to an issue that you have mentioned again and again about the lack of resources that are provided to the administration to really work with the districts. And I just can't believe it that every time we talk about, I've been concentrating my efforts on ELL and integration, and they just don't have staff to work on these issues. So I would like to move in that direction of oversight and technical support for the districts. but that requires more money, and I am not sure that we have it. So we have specific language in this bill that we could use some of this funding, but I do want to engage this committee in that conversation because I don't believe that we can really work on enforcement, accountability, and oversight without the resources. So that's a very good question, and I think we want to enter into, you know, establishing the language to say we need oversight, we need accountability, and somebody actually has to be responsible than that, and clearly that is the department. But I want to bring to your attention that we just don't have the resources to do it. So that's why we are kind of gently getting into that conversation. So that's one issue for that particular question, Senator Nelson. The second one, the whole issue of pursuing racial and economic integration has been actually the conversation that we want to engage again and again, and I think you and I have talked about this issue constantly, which is, you know, what is the issue that brings these gaps to the level that we have them in Minnesota? Is it related to poverty or it isn't? Integration opens the door to that conversation in a very, in a very critical way, but in a very profound way, because we give dollars to the districts to actually answer the question of integration. The reason we have economic here is because we think that we cannot separate that. And so what we want to do is engage districts in the conversation of pairing, doing work, collaboration amongst districts and schools that actually look for that issue of integrating racially and economically, because a lot of these kids, you know, live in low-income communities that are neighboring very affluent communities. And so these low-income communities happen to be predominantly communities of color. You see that a lot with Latinos who live in housing that is kind of placed in there in the parks, you know, the trailer parks, and they are placed in a community that is very affluent, and that trailer park is positioned there. And then you have these very, you know, high concentrated group of Latinos, predominantly Latino families that are very low income, neighboring a very affluent group. So we want to know what integration means in a situation like that. How do you integrate a group of kids that come to live in a trailer park into a community that is more affluent? How does that district going to do creative work on integrating that community that is very low income, has housing that is just completely different from the rest of the neighboring community, and how districts begin to kind of move in a direction of serving both independently of the ethnic language background as well as the economic background of those families who are located in that particular group. So that's just one example, but we have multiple examples that speak to the need for integrating communities that are very low-income, schools that serve very low-income kids into, you know, more affluent communities.
Senator Nelson. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres-Ray, I did want to make clear that I do see some new oversight and focus in this bill, so I didn't want to neglect that. I just needed to get some clarification on economic integration and what that means.
Thank you, Senator.
I do appreciate the fact that you've done some really innovative things here as far as Section 2, Subdivision 2, and Paragraph C. I think that's extremely innovative, and that does put some accountability measures in place. I should back up and say, first, there's the report, of course, so we actually measure achievement. So we know what we're going after, which is student achievement, closing the achievement gap, and then you're asking for a report to measure that. And then there's the accountability piece, which I see here in line 3.3, 4, and 5. And I think that's what's needed today. And so I'm glad you've included that in the legislation. I do see that there isn't a reduced by percent there. So it's a blank line. And I have an amendment, an oral amendment, to fill that line.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, could you take me back to the final? I was trying to locate.
Yes. Page 3. line 3.3, 3.4, and 3.5. Mm-hmm. I think that's the innovative piece in this bill. Mm-hmm. It is that after you have defined what we're after, which is closing the achievement gap, student achievement, and then you've required the report measuring that, then you have added in lines 3.3, 4, and 5, 3.32, 3.3, 3.4, and 3.5, you have added, I think, what would be a real accountability piece, which is that districts that do not meet their achievement goals as established for the biennium must have its initial achievement and integration revenue reduced by blank percent for the current year. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a good piece of accountability in there. And I don't see a number for the percent, and so I'll offer an oral amendment, and I'll be anxious to hear, obviously, the author's view on this. I would offer a 10% amendment for the current year, so the 3.35 would be reduced by 10% for the current year. And I would like to...
You move that amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move that amendment, Madam Chair.
First of all, members, this will be going to the Finance Division, and I think that would probably be a more appropriate place to put it on. The amendment is before us. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Nelson. Actually, I want to go higher than you go, just because I think that if we do...
I withdraw my amendment.
We had Senator gone higher.
I do, Senator Nelson, and I want
you're
that to be...
Nice.
Actually, that's the reason I said it, because I want it to be on the record. This percentage is kind of an important exercise, and is an exercise that I wanted to make sure that we do with the department, because I want to review the formula that Mr. Melcher has produced for us more carefully. And I, to be honest, I wanted to concentrate today on the policy aspect and wanted to have that discussion. I do believe that we have to be a little aggressive with the percentage, because if not, you know, we heard from districts who are doing great work, and they didn't need this legislation. They just felt like they needed to do it. And others who were just really not moving in that direction. So it seems like no matter what incentive we provide, they were just not ready to do it. So I do believe, Senator Nelson, that I want to be very, I don't know if aggressive is the word, but I do want to be very clear on really we're going to do everything to provide you with flexibility, with technical support. But if at the end, and that's the reason I put the language, you know, we're going to give you even more time. We're not going to take the money away. We're going to give you 4 years, but we're going to take the money. I mean, if you're not doing the work, the money is not going to be given to you, but to the districts that actually do the work. So if you don't mind, Senator, you know, I'm not against putting the 10% if you wish to do that today. But just to clarify to the members that I may change that
Senator Torres-Ray,
the Finance Committee.
You know, it seems to me that we might need to get some different, more testimony. If
correct.
We put in a number like this, there might be people who have an opinion that is important for us to hear.
That's
Senator
correct.
Nelson.
Senator Torres-Ray, I did withdraw my amendment, and I will certainly leave it to your visit. I do think it's important to have a more thoughtful approach than just a straight 10%. I think 10% should be the floor. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very comfortable taking my amendment off the table, knowing that you are going to work for an aggressive accountability piece here, which I would assume would be more than 10%. I thought 10% was the floor. So I'll remove my amendment.
First, let me state
10%.
For the record then that Senator Nelson did withdraw the amendment. I thought it was kind of a moment. Didn't know if it was serious. But Senator Nelson withdraws the amendment.
Thank
for
you,
10%.
Madam Chair. And just if and I may say, Madam Chair, maybe we can also think, as you were speaking, Senator Nelson, I'm thinking that maybe we can say reduce at a minimum by. And so that gives us, you know, the commissioner could say, you know, for some districts, the 10% is not enough. So we may do something like that, but I'd like to just really have these conversations.
Senator Nelson.
So, Senator Torres-Ray, I'm not going to offer that amendment at all because I don't want it to become the ceiling. Right. In my mind, it was a minimum floor, but mm-hmm. you have a vision of mm-hmm. A stronger accountability piece, and so I've totally withdrawn the amendment and entrust that you will go forward with some stronger accountability there.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate that. And there is one written amendment that I have that I'd like to offer, and that is the A3 amendment. And this goes, again, to making sure that we have results that we can measure. And, again, that was part of the OLA report in 2005. And so while that amendment is being handed out, I'll just kind of describe. It's actually easier to describe than it is to read the way it's. And so the gist
tell
of.
Tell us where it is, page number.
Yes. So the amendment is on page 3, and it's addressing lines 3.3 through 3.14. But what it's. The gist of the amendment is. Specifically stating what that longitudinal data that you're requiring, which is so important. Line 3.3 says the longitudinal data required under paragraph A must be based on one or more of the following measures. And you will see there it lists six measures. And there's one of those measures that stands out that should be, I think, on its own. And that is measure 2 on line 3.7 and 3.8. That's what we're trying to make sure is happening, which is student growth and progress towards proficiency in reading or mathematics. And that is what I see as the one thing that we need to, that we can measure, and we need to make sure that we have every student who is growing towards that proficiency in reading and mathematics. And so my amendment requires the longitudinal data to include that plus one or more of the following measures. So at a minimum, it would include the student growth and progress toward proficiency in reading and math, plus then any of the other measures that you have listed there in lines 3.3 through 3.14.
Are we in here?
Does everyone have an amendment, and are you clear about what it does to the bill? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to read the language right now. Page 3, delete 7 and 8, which is delete lines 7 and 8. I'm just reading it yes. right now.
Sure.
Part of the problem that I see here is so by deleting 7 and 8, and let me walk through it with you, Senator, you delete student growth progress, which clearly, I don't think it's a good idea because we need to measure student growth. But
and maybe,
you said
maybe.
Line 9 deletes 3 and inserts 2. So
Senator Torres-Ray,
yes.
maybe we let
I'm going to let staff explain it
that
because
be
that's not the intent. And
great.
I'm going to let
thank
staff
you.
Explain how they
I
wrote
just
this.
Make sure that I understand it.
Madam Chair, members, the way the bill was written the longitudinal data could be based on any one of those numbered, 1 through 6. What Senator Nelson is trying to do with her A3 amendment is saying that it has to be based on the student growth, which was number 2 in that list, and then one or more of the other measures that were 1, 3, 4, 5, or 6 on that list. So basically the deletion is taking item 2 out of that list because it's moved up and everyone has to use that for their longitudinal data.
So, Madam Chair and Ms. Butler, at the end, do we keep the measure on student growth or not? That's my main concern.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, yes, you keep it. Everybody has to use that as their measure, and then they get a choice of the remaining measurements.
So the Senator Torres-Ray, so the number 2 words in lines 3, 7, and 8 become a specific requirement for all of, I mean, that is one requirement. In other words, you'll be asking for 2 requirements because this one is the first one and then another one.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson, is that correct?
Senator Torres-Ray, that, and Madam Chair, that's correct. And so I am taking your language, Senator Torres-Ray, that is so important to you and I think is so important to every student in Minnesota, which is that we see student growth and progress towards proficiency in reading and math. And it is now an essential universal requirement of all longitudinal data. Plus one of the other options. And the reason I did that was because as I was looking at this longitudinal data requirement, the way the bill is written at the moment, the one measure that a school district could choose to measure might be option 6 on line 3.14 and 3.15, school safety, students' engagement, and connection at school. Well, those are fine things, but that is not sufficient, I don't think, in measuring the effectiveness of an integration program. So that's why I offered the amendment to say the longitudinal data must include the language in 3.7 and 3.8 plus one of the other five measurements that you have listed.
Do you have any further questions, Senator Torres-Ray?
No, I'm up with Senator Clausen.
Okay, Senator Clausen.
I'm wondering, Senator Nelson, if we could add writing to that.
Simple. Oh, Madam Chair, I accept that as a very friendly amendment to my amendment.
Thank you.
I hope Senator Torres-Ray does also.
I couldn't hear him. Sorry, Senator. If we could add, I couldn't hear what.
I'm sorry.
Okay, Senator Clausen, I'm looking at the amendment. It says proficiency in reading or mathematics or writing. Is that what you are saying?
Reading, writing.
Because it is not reading and mathematics. But again, there will be time in the E-12 Finance Committee to work out these issues if people are willing to wait, since the clock is at 2:35 now and some people probably have other commitments that they've made previous. Is there anything? The amendment is before us, and
to the amendment,
Senator Clausen, let me question: are you going to put and mathematics, or I mean, and writing, or writing? So, in other words, you would be able to measure either reading, or mathematics, or writing.
That's correct, Madam Chair. That was my intent based upon the original amendment that's been proposed.
So then the wording would be or writing after mathematics. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, you'd have to take out, Madam Chair, members, the amendment should be after reading, delete, or, and insert a comma, and then after mathematics, insert comma or writing.
Senator Nelson, do you think that changes your amendment from what it was?
I'm very glad for this discussion, and I certainly want to include writing, but I must add the intent of my amendment, which I see was not accurately captured here, is it should be and. So it should be towards proficiency in reading, math, and writing, as Senator Clausen has added.
And members and Senator Torres-Ray, that would change then the number 2 language that you had in your bill, 3.7 to 3.8, because you in that bill say reading or mathematics. That is definitely a change in your bill. Not an addition, but a change.
That's correct. I'm okay with that, Senator.
Okay.
So my amendment as amended with Senator Clausen.
Let's let council read it through once more and have everyone agree.
So, Madam Chair, members, on 1.3 of the A3 amendment, after reading, delete or and insert a comma. After mathematics, insert comma and writing.
Did you say and for all three? Well, read it again, please.
Madam Chair, how about I will explain how it will read after the amendment, if the amendment were adopted. On 1.3, it would read reading, mathematics, and writing.
As defined. Everyone clear on the amendment?
Madam Chair, I'm clear on that. That's fine. So in Senator Nelson's amendment, as we move forward with deleting the language of 7 and 8 and then proceed to update and insert 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is deleted from the bill. So for all of the listed 3 and insert 2, delete 4, and insert 3, delete 5, and insert 4, delete 6, and insert 5. 6 is out.
No, Senator Torres Ray.
Madam Chair, members, number 6 gets renumbered as number 5 because you took 2 out of the list.
So they are all in there. Okay, I want to make sure.
Yes.
I want to make sure that they are all in there. Thank you.
I'm ready to vote on the amendment as amended and read by counsel.
Chair.
Senator Wicklin.
I have a question to the amendment. Changing that to and, are you indicating that if they're demonstrating progress, it needs to be in all 3 of those areas within the time frame that they're measuring?
Senator Nelson.
Senator, my understanding of this section of the bill is what is the longitudinal data requiring. And so the longitudinal data is requiring that we see a student's growth towards proficiency in reading and writing and math.
And just towards, not proficiency.
Senator Wicklund, follow up.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to understand whether schools are going to be measured, if they're going to need to demonstrate progress in all 3 to be considered as fulfilling their plan. And I could be wrong on this, but that's what it looks like to me.
And one question that I have then for Senator Torres Ray, would this then, if you weren't proficient in any of those 3 categories, would you then be denied the funding that we're going to fill in that percentage amount later?
Approval process. You have to make it public and then submit it.
Senator, remember, we have 2 things going in this bill. The first one is that that the report that they will meet with the commissioner, it says, you know, they will have time in the 2 years to come and just kind of talk about their plan. And if that doesn't, if they don't meet that criteria, then there will be a percentage that they lose, and that's what we were talking about earlier. So ultimately, they will lose some funding, but we haven't determined the percentage. But the answer is yes, eventually, and I think that's good.
To this point, it's salient to
Senator
the point.
Senator Peterson and then Senator Clausen.
The language on 3.7 does not say that you must be proficient. It just says that you're making progress toward proficiency. The standard's very different.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
We knew what proficient is. Senator Clausen.
Yeah, Madam Chair, going back to the discussion we had on line 3.33, 3.35, and as Senator Torres Ray, as you look at this, I would suggest you look at it a tiered, in other words, a 10% on math, let's say, a 10% on reading, a 10% on writing, or perhaps there are other goals that warrant 25% and others are 10%. So when you enter into that discussion, you take that into account. So it's just not a simple 10% across the board if you don't make the math standard, but rather you look at a tiered approach for each of those individual goals that you set, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Senator, I'm very open. You know, as I said, this is going to go, this particular portion of how we distribute, it's going to go to Senator Wigger, so I'm very open to suggestions.
Right, and I think it is time for voting, and we can change it in the E-12 committee if you decide different or try to. The amendment, yes. We vote on the amendment. Now the A3 amendment as amended.
Roll call, please.
Roll call. The clerk will get the vote.
That'd be a roll call.
Do we need a roll call?
Yeah.
If she calls for it.
Senator Torres Ray.
Yes.
Senator Dahl.
I didn't call it.
Senator Nelson?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Chamberlain?
Yes.
Senator Clausen?
Yes.
Senator Franzen?
Yes.
Senator Johnson?
No.
Senator Kent?
Yes.
Senator Nenow?
Yes.
Senator Peterson?
Yes.
Senator Rood?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Wieger? Senator Wicklund?
Yes.
The amendment is adopted by a 13-1 vote. And Senator Torres Ray, let me explain. The reason is because I think for myself, I don't fully understand the implications of this, what I consider to be quite a large change in the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the issues that I think is important, I think that I say this here, I would have loved to have a conversation with you, Senator Nelson, about this change, because I think that we're after the same thing. I think we have a different opinion sometimes about, you know, kind of these drastic measures and how do we impose this and kind of move this huge thing that is before us and move it in a different direction. And some of you are more impatient. Some of us are very impatient about how the movement needs to take place. So I think the two of us share that. We're very impatient. We're ready for that change. But sometimes, you know, I feel that we bring this forward and in practical terms, it just cannot be done. Even though our desire is there, there's just too many pieces that need to move. So my caution many times is that although I want to go there, I have been really reading day and night a lot of these things, and it's just hard to impose something that may backfire on us, that has an unintended consequence.
Senator Torres Ray, I would suspect you and Senator Nelson will have some discussions before the E12 meeting. I hope that will be the case, and I hope that we can make our comments very short. I have a commitment at 3:45. Actually, it should have been earlier, so if someone else wants to take over the chair, I can leave, but otherwise I would like to vote. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Torres Ray, and I actually strongly supported the amendment. I thank you for being open-minded in the process here, and I actually think, just to point out, I mean, just to give you some moral support here, it actually aligns your bill a lot more. I mean, if you look at subdivision 2, lines 2.23 and 2.4 of your plan components, you've created formative assessment practices around those very same standards. So I think in many respects your bill is much more aligned with the professional development and formative assessment than it was coming in. So I just want to thank you for that.
All right. Senator Torres Ray, is there anybody else? Senator Nenow?
I'll just say I echo a lot of those comments. And one food for thought, Senator, for your next committee. I don't want to get into it now because we're running out of time. But line 3.1, you have the school district submitting a budget to the commissioner on March 1st, and then by June 1st they have to approve and disapprove. What happens if they disapprove? What then? And we don't need to get into that now, but food for thought for the next committee.
Thank you. Any other questions? After you made your notes, Senator Torres Ray, do you want to move your bill as amended?
Thank you, Senators. I really appreciate all of your support. And again, you know, we will continue to have a conversation about the formula and everything before Senator Wieger's committee. So I move that Senate file 1083 be recommended to pass and re-refer to Education Finance.
Bill number 711.
Sorry.
On that motion, Senate File 711 as amended.
711.
Be recommended to pass and sent to Education Finance.
Correct.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And I think we get to adjourn, right, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Meeting is adjourned. Yes.